it's a digital copy of what I have here. There are some very fascinating, interesting extra tidbits in the hard copy that aren't in the electronic copy. But this is a digitized 1560 Geneva Bible, all right? So we'll be making reference to this a couple times probably, and if not, it just serves as a nice visual for us as we get started. So let's get into the introduction here. Last week in Lesson 127, we wrapped up our discussion of the 1557 Geneva New Testament. All told, we consider the following points about the Geneva New Testament. So number one, we looked at the religious makeup of the Genevan exiles. So again, these are that group of Englishmen that take refuge in Geneva, Switzerland, in Calvin's Geneva during the reign of Bloody Mary. Mary comes to the throne, she tries to move England back under the jurisdiction of the Pope, and she then proceeds to persecute these Protestants. And so a group of them is going to take refuge in Geneva, Switzerland, and they're going to be the group that's responsible for the Geneva Bible. Second, we looked at possible translator or translators. Many believe that William Whittingham was primarily responsible for the 1557 Geneva New Testament. I would say I have no reason to really disagree with any of the evidence that I've read about that. Remember, that's because of the I statements that are found in that preface or in that epistle dedicatory in the 1557 Geneva New Testament. Again, we've talked about all this, so I'm just reviewing here. We looked at the prefatory information and features. So we looked at the title page, we looked at Calvin's introduction, and we looked at the address to the reader. So that address to the reader is where we had those I statements, which leads many to believe that Whittingham is the one that is responsible. Okay, we looked at the font, we looked at the verse numbers, we looked at the use of italics, all of which were new in the Geneva New Testament. So it's the first Bible, English Bible, to have verse numbers. It's the first Bible to italicize words in the text that were provided by the translator that for which there was no Greek support, right? So in other words, English words necessary to complete the thought are italicized for the first time. Then we looked at the book and chapter headings, or what were known as the arguments, and then we spent time looking at the marginal notes. And then we spent time looking at the text of the 1557 Geneva New Testament and comparing it to Tyndale and to the King James so that we could get some clear understandings of that. So today in Lesson 128, we want to begin looking at the 1560 complete Geneva Bible. So 3 years later, in 1560, they issue a complete Bible. So 1557, they did the New Testament, and then 3 years later, they're going to do a complete Bible from Geneva, all right? So that's what we want to start looking at. In doing so this morning, I want to cover the following points. Number one, I want to look at the death of Mary the First. Second, I want to talk about the Geneva Academy and assessing the Geneva Bible scholarship. And third, we want to look at the production and influence of the Geneva Bible, all right? So I'm just going to give you a heads up. There's a lot to say. This is a very, very important Bible in the history of the English language, and as far as the printed history of the Bible, as a precursor to the King James, all right? In fact, I've talked a lot, and we'll see more, I'm going to show you more in the future, how the King James Bible is a revision of the Bishop's Bible. According to rule number one, they were to follow the Bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original said otherwise. In areas, in readings where the King James differed from the Bishop's Bible, the majority of the time, not every time, but the majority of the time, they're going to give the Geneva reading in the King James. So this is an important addition as far as history, as far as impact on the English language, and a lot of things that we need to understand about it. It's also the first Bible to translate the entire Old Testament out of Hebrew. Remember that Tyndale did that, but that he died or was martyred before he finished, right? And then the folks that came after him translated out of Latin and out of other vernacular translations, not out of Hebrew. So the Geneva Bible is very significant and important for a variety of reasons related to the text that are going to impact the King James Bible that we read today. So let's look at the first. All right, I'm getting ahead of myself. Does anybody have any questions or comments about the review or the introduction? All right, so let's look at the first short point here. should say, for those of you that may be watching this live, if you're on YouTube, there's a link in the description for the notes. And if you're on Facebook, you can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com and click on the lesson and access the notes. So you want to look for lesson 128. It's right at the top under recent sermons, okay? Death of Mary the First. So the publication of the 1557 Geneva New Testament preceded the death of Bloody Mary, or Mary the First, by about 1 year. So the Geneva New Testament is published in 1557. The next year, 1558, Mary is going to die, all right? Mary's death in November 1558 would alter the fortunes, that should say fortunes, alter the fortunes of both the Geneva exiles and the English Bible. Dr. Donald L. Brake, author of A Visual History of the English Bible, states the following about these events. He says, quote, "The long exile of the Protestant reformers was nearly over. The death of Queen Mary on November 17, 1558, and the ascension of Elizabeth I to the throne signaled a safe return of the exiles back to England. So when Mary dies in 1558, the way is now cleared for these folks to start going home, all right, start going back to England, because the threat and the danger of Mary's reign is now over, and so a lot of them start to move back home. A few remained in Geneva to complete the translation already underway." Why did that go blue? That's weird. While contributors to the 1550 Geneva were Anthony Gilby, Christopher Goodman, William Cole, and Thomas Sampson, the guiding force in his production was William Whittingham again. So Whittingham is going to factor heavy in the New Testament in 1557. He's going to be the primary driving force of the complete Geneva Bible in 1560. So that's just a brief point, okay? But you need to understand that when Mary dies and Elizabeth becomes queen, a bunch of these people go home. A small contingency stay in Geneva for the sole purpose of finishing what? Of finishing this project that they had already started. So the majority of them go home, but this small contingency of men stay behind for the purpose of completing the Geneva Bible. So let's talk a little bit about the Geneva Academy assessing the Geneva Bible scholarship. Now, you know, if you paid attention to any of the recent things, a lot of people seem to have a hard time with scholarship. And they don't like the fact that, you know, they don't like higher learning, they don't like some of these things, or at least they have a real sort of natural propensity to kick against it. But you need to understand that the Bible that we love and appreciate in the King James Bible and English as English-speaking people is the result of brilliant scholarship on the part of the King James translators themselves, but also in the context and situation that gave us the Geneva Bible, right? And so we need to understand and appreciate these things accurately for what they are. So the impact of the Geneva Bible on both English Christians and the English language cannot be overstated. Once it appeared in 1560, the Geneva Bible became the Bible of the common Englishman for the next century. All right, look at the quote. "This compact volume in size and moderate quarto, which is with its excellent text, generally in Roman type and numbered verses set out in two columns." So let me just show you what that's talking about here. So here's the text. Here's Genesis chapter 1. And you can see the text is set forth here in two columns with numbered verses. And then you have extensive, look at how extensive the marginal notations are on this Bible. It's far more annotated than anything that we've seen previous to this in our studies. But you can see that you have a two-column chapter there with clearly numbered verses in Roman type that is much easier to read than that old Gothic font that we've been looking at in some of the previous Bibles. Remember when I showed you pictures and I showed you that Matthew's Bible, you couldn't even hardly read it, okay? So its compact volume and its size in moderate quattro, with its excellent text generally in Roman type and numbered verses set out in two columns, had in addition had what accounted to an encyclopedia of Bible information. So let's just look at just this one page, all right? So here's the first book, the creation of the world, the first book of Moses called Genesis, and then you have this argument. So this is background information about the book of Genesis. And then you have massive annotations and footnoting on both columns, right? So if I'm an English-speaking person and I buy this Bible, I'm not only buying the biblical text, but am I buying all this information? So I'm having access to a bunch of explanatory information. Now, I'll just be honest with you. It is not all dispensationally oriented, all right? It is not rightly divided footnoting. It is not footnoting that is, and so forth, that is recognizing the distinctive message and ministry of the Apostle Paul. And a lot of it is Calvinistic in its theology. But we have to understand that there's a ton of stuff in the footnotes of the Geneva Bible that theologically I would disagree with. But what we're trying to understand is the historical document for what it is. And for what it is there a ton of information in this Bible that the buyer now has access to, right? So it was very popular and successful indeed. It was a masterpiece of Renaissance scholarship and printing and Reformation Bible thoroughness. Having been the people's Bible in the latter 16th and early 17th centuries, it was driven out by political and commercial interests from 1611 and forced out of the public view from 1660. So this is the Bible. Understand that this is the Bible of the common Englishman for 100 years. From 1560 to 1660, the majority of the common populace of England was reading what Bible? The Geneva Bible. So even when the King James Bible comes out in 1611, for another 50 or 60 years, what remained the Bible of choice for most English-speaking people? The Geneva Bible. Okay, now let me just address that briefly. There's this idea, I'm going to call it a misconception, there's a misconception that King James advocates have that the English-speaking world, the moment the King James Bible rolled off the press in 1611, that the English-speaking world was like, oh, finally, God's Word in our language. That is not what happened. Okay? And there's strong evidence, I will show you, where even after, you need to understand that the biblical references in the preface to the 1611 King James Bible, the quotes in it, are taken from the Geneva Bible. Not from the Bible that they're printing. Okay? So, there's a ton of things that people say about the King James Bible that just are not true. They're just factually and historically not true. Alright? There are sermons of translators after the King James Bible, guys who were translators and sat on the committee, in their sermons, they're still using what Bible? They're still using the Geneva Bible. The quotations and the biblical allusions and their uses of Scripture in their sermons even after 1611 were from the Geneva Bible. Now, why would that be? Because the populace was still using what Bible? The Geneva Bible. Okay? We saw in Lesson 125 in our discussion of the 1557 Geneva New Testament, Geneva, Switzerland had established itself as a haven for the production of Protestant vernacular Bibles. Quote, the year 1557 and the city of Geneva were both the time and the place for a new English translation. For 20 years, revisions of Olivetan's French New Testament had been published at Geneva, revised by Calvin and the Geneva ministers, the latest in 1556. Italian exiles there printed and revised the Italian New Testament in 1555. On the way to a whole Bible, a revised New Testament in Spanish was printed there in 1556. So what you need to understand from that is that Geneva, Switzerland was a hotbed for Protestantism and Protestant Bible printing in the languages of the people. French Bibles, Italian Bibles, Spanish Bibles, and English Bibles are all going to be printed in Geneva, Switzerland and sent all over Europe. Obviously to those people, those different people groups that spoke those languages, all right? So there is no small this was in no small measure due to the academic and scholastic climate established by the Academy of Geneva under the leadership of Theodore Beza. Or Beza, I've heard people say both ways. Dr. David Daniels states the following about Beza's academy. Why does this keep doing this? It's not going to touch it, okay? He states the following about the Geneva Academy in the English, in the Bible in English, its history and influence. He says, quote, "The Academy of Geneva under Beza was based on a model established in Strasbourg." So that was in Germany, and that would have been Luther and Melanchthon. So they were the first guys. They established this academy. You need to understand that from the very beginning, from the very inception of the Protestant movement, it was a highly academic movement. These guys cared a lot about the biblical text, about the study of the original languages, and about accurately translating those original languages into the languages of Europe. So Geneva has established, for good or bad, however you feel about John Calvin, and I got a lot of negative feelings about John Calvin and his theology, but however you feel about him and how he ran Geneva, he established there an academic climate that allowed for Protestant study of the Bible to thrive. All right? The aim was a specialized one of educating men in large numbers. A learned ministry was also the goal of the reformers in whatever country. Now let me comment on that. One of the major problems of the Catholic Church in the medieval period is the fact that the parish priests were illiterate. They couldn't read. All they had done is memorize the liturgy in Latin, and all they would do is just recite it. They literally couldn't read. So when the Protestant movement comes along and they adopt the mantra of sola scriptura, the idea that scripture alone should be the authority, embedded within that is the idea that our ministers need to be educated. They need to be able to read the Bible for themselves. They need to be able to teach the Bible for themselves. And that was all part of this whole thing that occurred back then. The academy began with 162 students, but 5 years later, in 1560, it had 1,500. The educational ideal was much broader than studying theology. The last decades of the 16th century, Geneva became, for many distinguished Englishmen, a necessary place in which to study. Beza scholars were the specialist experts in the humane work of editing ancient texts. The first texts that Calvin edited were classical, and his love for and knowledge of the Greek and Roman writers were profound. The weightiest work, however, was the making of vernacular Bibles from the best Hebrew and Greek texts. So that's what these guys were about. That is their focus. Their focus is taking the preserved Hebrew and Greek and making accurate vernacular Bible translations of those languages. All right? As usual, let's stop there. Anybody got any questions or comments? All right. As usual, Dr. Daniel offers the most detailed information about the Academy of Geneva. That said, his comments are simply too long and would require more time to cover than I would like to devote to this point. That's a little weird there. To consider them in detail. Therefore, we will look at the pared down. I think that's the wrong. Is that the wrong pared down? Is that right?
No, that's right.
That's right. All right. Pared down comments of Dr. Brake and the scholarship. On the scholarship of the men responsible for the Geneva Bible. So go to top page 3. When we consider the credentials of the men involved in this translation, there is little room left to quibble about the quality of its production. Some of the greatest theologians in Christian history, including John Calvin, whose introduction to the 1557 New Testament appeared in English, John Knox and Theodore Beza, known for publishing several Greek New Testaments, took part in the Geneva Bible Project. Modern scholars have no problem admitting that it was one of the finest translations ever made. Charles Butterworth acknowledges the influence of the Geneva Bible when he writes, "In the lineage of the King James Bible, this volume is by all means the most important single volume." He adds, It was for 50 years, 1570 to 1620, the household Bible of the English people. It was the Bible of Shakespeare after 1597 and the Bible of the Puritans coming to America. Even some of the translators of the 1611 King James Version continued to use it as late as the mid-1620s. So that was what I was alluding to earlier, right? That, is that going to bother anyone?
No.
It's just stained, all right? I don't know why it keeps doing that. But this is a fact, right? And it's an inconvenient fact to many pro-King James folks, that the translators themselves would continue to use the Geneva Bible in their preaching even after they had finished the King James Bible. But this is a fact of history. I will show you this when we look at actual sermons. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'm going to give you actual citations from sermons where they're using the Geneva Bible, not the King James. The sources for the translation of the Geneva Bible can be traced to Greek, Hebrew, Latin, French, and English forerunners. The Greek text of Stephanus, 1551, and Beza's Latin, 1555, were used in the New Testament. The English text source was primarily the 1557 Geneva with reference to Tyndale's edition, published by Richard Jugg in 1552, and the Great Bible, 1539 through 1541. The French Bible of Pierre Olivetan, cousin of John Calvin, the Latin Bible of Pongentius, the Hebrew Latin of Sebastian Munster, and the Latin of Leo Juda were also sources consulted. Now, that doesn't mean they followed all that, it just means they what? They consulted it. They looked at what all of those sources had to say. So this is not a bunch of dummies sitting in a back room saying, what should the Bible say? They're looking at the best stuff they have available to them to decide what the reading should be as they're translating. Professor Daniel offers the following comment about the scholastic and literary context of Geneva during those years. In addition to Calvin and Beza, the scholar printers in Geneva, Robert Erstein, that's Stephanus, Conrad Battis, John Crespin, Jean Girard, Nicholas Barrier, all these guys, made 22 French Bibles. This was the context in which there appeared in April 1560 the first Geneva Bible. All right, so any questions or comments before we move to the next point? Yeah?
I'm sorry, did you say why some of those translators
did I say why in these notes or somewhere else?
I did say
why, at least in part. At least in part is because they're preaching to people who still had this in front of them. So they had not, the English-speaking world had not immediately laid this aside in favor of this. Now, eventually that happens, but it's about 50 years after this is printed. So, did they see any problem with preaching from this? They did not. The very guys that were responsible for this had no problem with preaching from a Geneva Bible. Now again though, think about a lot of stuff and rhetoric that you've heard. A lot of the rhetoric that is repeated gives the impression that the King James translators were somehow otherworldly, inspired, and that they had all this, you know, that there's something mystical and supernatural going on between 1604 and 1611. When that is not at all the case, and even after it was done, two facts, people didn't immediately lay this aside in favor of the King James. And not only that, the King James translators themselves, in many cases, continued to preach and teach from a Geneva Bible. So, again, the facts are sometimes inconvenient, as we are finding out, but... Did you have a follow up?
Well, not necessarily a follow up, but the King James
the New Testament.
How much of the Geneva?
So let's, good question, so let's think about that. You remember last week and the week before, I had the notes up here with the tables, and I showed you how there are, we looked at least 10 verses where the King James text was virtually untouched from Tyndale. It came through all untouched, right? So if that 1557 Geneva New Testament was 83% Tyndale, and this is a revision of that, this is also what? 83% what? Tyndale. The next Bible that we'll talk about after this one is the Bishop's Bible, which was a revision of the Great Bible. But the Great Bible was 83% what? Tyndale. So if the King James Bible is a revision of the Bishop's Bible with alternative readings from the bishop supplied by Geneva, the King James Bible is 83% what? Tyndale. In the New Testament. And the reason I say that is the following. Remember, Tyndale didn't finish the Old Testament. But if you take those portions of the Old Testament that Tyndale finished, and you were to analyze only those portions, the percentage of agreement between the King James and the Tyndalean portions of the Old Testament would probably be somewhere in that same percentage. Now, I'm making an educated speculation a little bit on that because I don't know of anyone who has done that data, that research for the Old Testament the way they've done it for the New Testament. But I know, so this is why what we've done has been so important, right? Because in 1537, Thomas Matthew moved all of Tyndale's work forward. Then the Great Bible was a revision of the Matthew's Bible. The Bishop's Bible was a revision of that. The King James was a revision of that. So what we end up with in the King James Bible is 83% Tyndale, a lot of it virtually unchanged since 1526. Okay? Am I answering your question? All right, any other questions? No? All right, let's look at production and influence. Let me just say one thing about that, though, before we move on. Guys, you know, I know some of you have been following the videos that I released this week. I cannot bring myself to advocate for a teaching in a viewpoint that is contrary to fact. I just can't do it. And if that means that, you know, that puts me at odds with some advocates of the King James, then I guess that's where I'm at. But I can't bring myself to say things that I know are not true because of what I know about what happened. And that's not meant to say, well, I know all of this and these folks don't. But what I'm saying is I don't understand why there is this instinctual reaction to think that we're trying to accomplish something negative here. You follow what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand that. I would think people would want more light and more understanding on these things, and unfortunately that seems to not always be the case. So I don't really know what else to say about that. Production and influence. Let's move to the next point. According to Dr. Drake, the volume was financed by John Bodley, whose family is the namesake of the famous Bodleian Library in Oxford. So, remember a few weeks back when I did the lesson on the brief history on the King James Only movement? Remember that lesson back in October? Yeah, see, I know you all have perfect memory of every lesson that I teach you. But a lot of the documents, a lot of the primary, remember I mentioned three primary documents, all of those are in, most of those are in Bodley, two of them are in Bodleian Library, and one of them is in Lambeth Palace. But he says, let's look at this quote, "Behind many great projects and deeds in history, a businessman can be found funding the dreams of scholars and entrepreneurs." Folks, let me just say, E.W. Bullinger, C.R. Stamm, J.C. O'Hare, many of these great dispensational thinkers and writers do not accomplish what they do apart from wealthy men funding their ministerial efforts so that these guys don't have to work other jobs, so that they can devote their whole time to what? To these issues. Okay? Same thing with this Geneva Bible. Behind many great projects and deeds in history, a businessman can be found funding the dreams of scholars and entrepreneurs. The Geneva Bible was primarily financed by the English exiles' benefactor, John Bodley, the father of Thomas Bodley, after whom the famous Bodleian Library in Oxford is named. Bodley was granted an exclusive 7-year printing license in England in 1560, which was renewed in 1565 for 12 more years. However, it was not printed in England. So this is not printed in England for nearly the first 20 years of its existence. Let's look at why. Alfred Pollard, recognized historical scholar, suggests that because the renewed calls for letting the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of London make conditions, such as the omission of notes, Bodley did not want to print it under these conditions. It was printed in England for the first time under the license purchased from Queen Elizabeth by Christopher Barker in 1576. So this thing comes into existence, guys, in 1560, and it's not printed on English shores until 1576, almost 20 years after it first appeared. Dr. Daniel concurs with Dr. Brake on the details regarding who financed the 1560 Geneva Bible. The costs of the making were borne by the English congregation generally and by one member of the wealthy merchant John Bodley, whose son Thomas would later found the Bodleian Library at Oxford. The circumstances that culminated in the publication of the 1560 Geneva Bible are as follows. Quote, "The simple lambs on the continent in England, so helped by William Whittingham's New Testament, surely needed a complete Bible on the same model. It was begun a few months after the 1557 Geneva New Testament, or the 1557 New Testament was published, and continued, we are told, for the space of 2 years and more, day and night. So the first Geneva Bible was made, printed by Rowland Hall, one of the English exiles, at his Geneva press in April 1560. Though Queen Mary had died on 17 November 1558, and all over the continent, exiles, said to number 800 in total during Mary's reign, returned to Protestant England under Good Queen Bess." So that was the nickname of Queen Elizabeth. "Good Queen Bess, some of the men who made the Geneva Bible remained there until it was completed in April 1560. Probably William Hand Gilby, Sampson, and probably Cole, Kethy, and Barron. An early copy was presented to Queen Elizabeth." And if you look at it, you will see, we'll talk about this more, but look at the dedication. "To the most virtuous and noble Queen Elizabeth of England, France, and Ireland." So this Bible, the dedication is to who? Queen Elizabeth. Any questions? The impact and influence of the Geneva Bible was felt far and wide. This remarkable volume, the first great achievement of Elizabeth's reign, printed in London and in Edinburgh in 1575, and always in large quantities, became at once the Bible of the English people. And it remained so through 140 editions. Editions, not just simple reprintings, before 1644. As will be seen in later chapters, the New Testament was revised once by Lawrence Thompson in 1576, and new notes by, Junius? And new notes by Junius replaced those in Revelation in 1599. In 1610, 50 years after the first making, all three versions were in full printing flood, 120 editions of all sizes having been made. It seemed that nothing would stop them. The translators working for King James after 1604 in aiming to make a good one better were referring to the Geneva Bible And in the King James Long Preface, the translators to the reader, they quoted scripture almost always from there, i.e. the Geneva. So in the preface, when they quote scripture, they're not quoting their own work, they're quoting this. But politics ruled. Lost my spot, sorry. Where am I at? But politics ruled. Even the inception in January 1604 of the 1611 King James was a political act by reactionary bishops against the Geneva Bibles. Boy, there's a lot to say about that. You need to understand that King James did not like this Bible because of some of the marginal notes were against the doctrine of divine right of kings. So you here you are, James, and you think you rule by divine right, right? In other words, who made you king? God, right? And so now the majority of the people in the populace that you rule over are reading this Bible that has marginal notes in it that question divine right of kings. Are you just going to be okay with that? Probably not. As will be seen, the large printing of the King James Version in 1611, in spite of its immediate unpopularity, was organized in order to push out the Geneva Bibles. Ugly and inaccurate quattro editions of the Geneva Bible, also falsely dated 1599, were printed in Amsterdam and possibly elsewhere in the Low Countries up to 1640 and smuggled into England and Scotland against establishment wishes. The last full text and notes in England were printed in 1644. Between 1642 and 1715, eight editions, now check this out, eight editions of the King James were published with Geneva notes. So that those are King James texts with Geneva marginal notes. Okay? Seven of them in folio and two of them in 1 year, 1679, statistics which tell their own story. The influence of the Geneva Bible is incalculable. Before the London printings, it was freely available in England in large enough numbers to stir Archbishop Parker into inviting his rival Bishop's Bible in 1568. You've got to understand, all this is political. All of this is political. It's political. I mean, why are they doing it in Geneva? Politics. Once it's done and they come back, it's political. Once the King James is published, it's political. When we get to the 1600s and we talk about the English Civil War, so this is about 30 or 40 years after the King James is published, there's a civil war in England, and the Puritans, under Oliver Cromwell, seize control of the government, and they ban the King James Bible and say everybody has to read what? The Geneva. Well, when the Puritans eventually lose and you have the restoration of the monarchy, guess what they're going to do? They're going to say, no more printing of what? The Geneva Bible. So the whole thing is influenced by the politics. I know I'm probably making people upset just talking right now, but the facts of the case, all right? The influence of the Geneva Bible is incalculable. Before the London printings, it was freely available in England in large enough numbers to stir Archbishop Parker into inviting his rival Bishop's Bible in 1568. For over 50 years, it was sometimes second to that in Anglican pulpits and on Anglican lecterns. So in other words, even after the Bishop's Bible came out, a lot of these folks continued to use the Geneva Bible. Even so, a study of more than 50 sermons by bishops between 1611 and 1630, including Andrews, the chief of the King James Revisers, and Laud, the enemy of all things ecclesiastical, shows that in 27 sermons, the preacher took his text from the Geneva Version. and only in five from the bishops. Of the remaining 20-odd, only half quoted from King James, and half seem to have made their own version. Think about those statistics. So Lancelot Andrew is one of the main translators in the King James Bible in, what, 27 sermons of hymn and laud. They take their text not from the King James, but from what? The Geneva. Now listen, I'm not telling you all that because I'm negative about the King James Bible. I'm telling you all of that because you need to understand the reality of this one and its influence and how it influenced people. The King James Bible was, however, the Bible of the English and the Scots. The Geneva Bible was, however, the Bible of the English and the Scots at home in local reading groups and prophesyings. In Scotland, the Edinburgh, and I don't know, the Sandine Bible of 1579, the first Bible printed in Scotland, a straight reprint of the first Geneva Bible in folio, made in 1561, was ordered to be in each parish kirk. That's a word for church. It was dedicated to Prince James. Who do you think that is?
King James.
That's later King James. Dedicated to Prince James, so much for his reported claim at Hampton Court Conference in 1604 that he had only recently been shown a copy. A Scottish Act of Parliament passed soon after the publication of the Bible made it mandatory that every householder worth 300 marks of yearly rent and every yeoman and burgess worth 500 pounds in stock should have a Bible and a psalm book in the vulgar tongue in their homes under penalty of 10 pounds, and there is evidence that this act was enforced. So now we have people being fined for not having a Bible, when before this, they are running away into Switzerland and Germany to get away from a queen who's burning them at the stake. And now you have a government that's so favorable toward the scriptures, they're actually fining people that don't have it. Okay? So early in the 17th century, the Geneva Bible was taken back to Europe, to Amsterdam and to other Netherlands separatist centers, and from there to America. Whereas successive waves of colonists landed, it flourished mightily. It was the Bible of the Elizabethan and Jacobin poets and prose writers, including Shakespeare. If Othello does say that the exemplar who threw the great pearl away was the base Judean, as the folio text has it, and not the, quote, base Indian, then he took the phrase with many more from the Geneva Bible. So in other words, when Shakespeare writes Othello, all of the biblical allusions and citations in Othello are coming from what? Coming from the Geneva Bible. J.R. Dorr, author of Old Bibles, an account of the early versions of the English Bible, states the following about the printed history of the Geneva Bible. Quote, the last quattro printed in England is dated 1615, the last folio 1616. So that's just talking about different sizes of Bibles. After this first time, and great many editions were printed in Amsterdam by Joost Bors and other Dutch printers, the last folio bears the imprint of Thomas Stamford and the date 1644. It professes to be copied from the Bible printed by Andrew Hart in Edinburgh in 1610. 150,000 copies were imported from Holland after this version had ceased to be printed in England. On account of numerous errors in its foreign printed editions, Archbishop Laud prohibited their importation, and Puritans brought this against him as a crime at the trial which terminated in his martyrdom. So, remember I said this about Cromwell and the Puritans taking over the government during the English Civil War? They execute this guy, this archbishop. Part of the charges against him are he banned the importation of the Geneva Bible into England. So, I mean, this was serious business to these folks. A.S. Herbert, author of Historical Catalog of Printed Bibles, Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 to 1961, offers some interesting statistics on the 1560 Geneva Bible. Quote, between 1560 and 1644, at least 140 editions appear to the Geneva Bible or Testament. 134, which are represented in the BH Library. So that's a library, that's the Bodleian Library in Oxford. So a lot of these have survived. 134 of these things have survived, different editions. Examination of the King James Bible of 1611 shows that its translators and correcting the bishops were influenced more by the Geneva than by any other English version. The Geneva Bible is often referred to as the Breeches Bible for its reading in Genesis 3:7. They sewed fig tree leaves together and made themselves breeches or britches. That's how they would have spelled britches. As it turns out, this famous oddity is not unique to the Geneva Bible. The Wycliffe New Testament of 1382 and Caxton's edition also use the term breeches. So we can actually look at that. So we'll find Genesis 3. And what verse? 7. There it is right here. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig tree leaves together and made themselves breeches. King James says aprons, I believe, in that verse. Okay, so this Bible has been, you know, nicknamed as a result the Breeches Bible. So last point, by 1642, the King James Version was overtaking the Geneva in popularity. This led Joost Grotius, whoever that guy is, in Amsterdam to print the King James Version with the Geneva notes in the margins. So that's an introduction to the Geneva Bible. So obviously there's a lot more things that we're going to look at in relationship to it, because it is an exceedingly important addition to make sure that we understand. So does anybody have any comments or questions about the lesson? That was part of the motivation for a new translation. Because when you read the directions, the instructions, one of the instructions explicitly states the parameters of marginal notes. That all they were for was clarifying the meaning of words and offering cross-references or alternative readings. They were not allowed to make doctrinal comment on the text. So if you study the notes in a 1611, you'll see that that's exactly what they do. So Bud, let me just, I'm not trying to be like cryptic on purpose, but I know in my mind, like 10 things I want to talk about down the road that we're not ready to talk about yet related to what you're asking me. But it was never an idea in his mind, the king's mind that is, to just publish the Geneva Bible without the marginal notes. Because he had other things he was trying to accomplish with that Bible. One of them was to strike a middle ground, a political middle ground between the bishops of the Anglican Church and the Puritans. And one of the ways he conceived to do that was to make a translation committee and put Puritans and Anglican bishops on the committee and force them to work together on this project. So there's a lot going on with this decision that is related to political things that are motivating James to do what he did. So at Hampton Court, imagine having an audience before a king back in the day, you know, or even before the president or whoever. Are you going to like just roll in and be like, hey, Presidente, what's up, man? how are you doing? Or are you going to need to have probably a pretty clear itinerary of what you're going to be talking about? So they have this meeting in January 1604 at Hampton Court, and the Puritans had submitted a slate of ideas for the king to discuss before the king, and the idea of a new translation wasn't even on the agenda. It was not on the agenda that the Puritans submitted to the king. The idea is thrown out. One of the writers that writes about this talks about with all the lightness of an afterthought. Reynolds, the chief Puritan speaker at the Hampton Court Conference, the chief representative of the Puritan contingency before the king, just says this about, well, would the king allow for another translation? And the Archbishop Bancroft ripped him in front of the king. It says, if you guys had your way, there would be no end to translating. And then, of course, I'm paraphrasing all this, but then James says, whoa, wait. Because he had already, and I can prove this through documentation, bud, but I'm not ready to do it right now. He had already, before he was King of England, while he was still King of Scotland only, in a meeting of the Scottish Kirk, already had a conversation with those guys about a new English translation. Because he didn't like what? So when Reynolds says to him, well, how about we have a new translation? Bancroft rips him, but the king's like, let's do it. Because he structures the thing in such a way to force these guys to work together. So there end up being Puritan and Anglican bishops on the translation committee to work on this project. Anyway, any other questions? Mike, you had a question? Did I answer your question? I probably told you more than you wanted. Yeah.
I think the reason that the name of the Bible hung on for so long is that everybody was so accustomed to it. Everybody had a copy. The language was a little bit different than the King James, and they were used to that reading. And so they just were reluctant to.
I think you could make the same argument in the 20th century about the King James and modern versions. I talked to you guys about this. The American, I can't speak for England, okay? American Christians did not lay aside the King James Bible for a modern version in large numbers until the 1950s and 60s. It just didn't happen. But then eventually that the floodgates are opened on that, and then, you know, and it's not even until, if my memory of statistics are right, it's not even until like the 1980s that the NIV overtook the King James as the best-selling Bible in America. But now we have the situation that we have now in the 21st century. But you're right, there's a parallel between the laying aside of the Geneva in favor of the King James and the laying aside of the King James in favor of modern versions. There's a parallel in the attitude of the people. The modern version is way different than a Geneva or a King James because it leaves tons of stuff out, as we already know. Okay. Anybody else? Comparison. The King James translators have all the resources that were available to these guys in 1560, plus more things, more editions of the Greek New Testament, mostly by Beza and other guys in Geneva that they had at their disposal, additional commentaries, writings, things that had been done between 1560 and 1604.
As well as
input from all these prior English Bibles, and any of the data and resources that these guys would have had in 1560. So. All right, we good? Everyone bored now? It's hot in here today. It's really hot in here. All right, we'll see you guys next week. We'll move on. My